The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here tonight. I know the schedule said that Nikki would be the teacher tonight, but she is a little under the weather, and so she called me this afternoon. And I was happy to be able to come. But I thought about that, actually, that, we can't really predict how the day is going to end when it begins. And our bodies as humans are subject to changes and sometimes to not behaving the way we want them to. We have these plans, but they don't seem to care that much. And also, I received this call from Nikki just as I was going out the door to volunteer as a spiritual caregiver at the hospital where I volunteer. And so, that's another place where there are people who are in situations that they weren't intending to have. And in addition, I was planning to have tea with a friend on Sunday, but she had to cancel because she has to fly to Maine due to a death in the family. So it seemed that these things were all coming together, and I thought I would talk a little bit about the practice of being present for our human sufferings like this, the normal expected ones like aging, illness, and death. And that our practice is really moving toward the place where we can be beneficial in situations like that. Not only are we, first of all, not overwhelmed by those very natural things that happen to humans, but in addition, the practice really reaches fruition when we can meet those and respond in some way that is actually helpful. So that's a process that we go through. We start out pretty much subject to the whims of these things that come through our mind and come through our bodies. And then we start to get above water. And then at some point, we're able to help others that are in situations like that. And this is a practice and a process. And I love that it's so natural that just learning to be mindful and compassionate has this effect in the world. So I'm actually going to just share some stories around some themes of times that I met people in the hospital as a spiritual caregiver, because this has been actually a very deep Buddhist practice for me to do that. And if you haven't done that personally, it doesn't matter. Many of us have been in situations of caring for others. That's what I'm really talking about. Taking care of a sick child, taking care of an elderly parent, looking out for a friend during a time when they were under the weather, shall we say. So I volunteer as a spiritual caregiver at Valley Medical Center, which is the county hospital in San Jose. I've done that for about 3 years. And I began actually during the Sati Center chaplaincy training program that they have, that is offered here. I mean, they meet here, it's through the Sati Center. And that requires 100 hours of field service to complete that training. So I did that at Valley Medical Center. And then I just stayed on. After that, I go about once a week. Now, truthfully, I don't see Buddhists very often because they try to give me as many Buddhists as they can, but in the general hospital around here, that's not the primary patients that are there. And most of the Buddhists that are there are Vietnamese, Korean, Japanese, Thai, other Asian nationalities. They may not speak English even. And many of them don't understand that they're Western Buddhists, so it's not even that helpful for me to present myself that way. They're not really aware that places like this exist, which is interesting. I actually feel more culturally connected, I think, to the Western Christians, even though I didn't myself grow up with a very strong religious background. But I've turned out, I learned, that I have absorbed a tremendous amount from living here. You know, it's just sort of part of the way of thinking. And it's been eye-opening for me. This is one of the Buddhist lessons, is to see how much Judeo-Christian ideology is kind of in my way of thinking, just from growing up in this culture. So mostly, of course, I'm seeing Catholics and Christians. Not that that's always that relevant, you know. Mostly what I'm doing is offering people a conversation that they don't have time to have with anybody else who's there. You know, the nurses and the doctors are busy taking care of their bodies, and they're not talking with the patients about, you know, what are you going through? How do you feel about this surgery that you're having? They don't have time for that, so that's my job, is to talk with them in that way. And sometimes it's easier with someone else, not with a family member, say. I encounter things every time I'm there that are relevant for Buddhist practice, and more generally for mindfulness practice, every single time. So I'm going to share some of those. The aim isn't that you're going to need to feel like you should go out and volunteer. We have different stages in our practice. Sometimes it's a good thing to do that. Sometimes it's not. But I want to give a flavor of the ways that our practice is relevant in all kinds of situations where there's suffering, you know, our own and that of other people. So the suffering in a hospital is definitely the type that none of us is immune from, either for ourselves or for our loved ones. So that's the first Dharma lesson, is that I'm not there to, you know, offer pity. Oh, I'm sorry you're in this situation and it's not going to happen to me. As often as I can, I remember that could be me. That will be me maybe someday. Very important lesson for us. So I'm just recalling some encounters that stood out, situations where I was called or challenged to be fully present, to fully let go, but also to be fully myself. And we're not trying to be some kind of abstract ideal in a hospital situation, especially when we're not with other Buddhists. This is about being real, about being human. But internally being true to the practice. So I think non-Christians actually have a bigger challenge in offering spiritual care in a situation like that, because, you know, how do I truthfully pray with someone, for example? So these are interesting situations, and we'll encounter them ourselves in our family, say, if we're caring for someone in our family who is different from us. So sometimes the best thing to do actually is just flow along and meet people where they are. So I came to see an older man one time in a unit that's kind of at a care level between intensive care and regular care, if you will. And he had what's called a sitter with him, which is someone who is a hospital staff member who sits with the person all the time. Usually it's because, you know, they just sit there by the bed. Usually it's because the person is in danger of harming themselves or getting up and leaving, something like that. Sometimes people are in an agitated state and they can't be trusted actually to just sit in the bed by themselves. So he had a sitter. His shoes were still on and he looked kind of disheveled. And it was clear in our initial exchange that he wasn't quite lucid, and I couldn't tell if that was because he had been given some medication, which is often the case, or if he had some dementia or some drug issue. I didn't really know. And when he understood that I was there as a spiritual caregiver, he told me proudly that he is a Southern Baptist, and he told me what river he was baptized in. So, okay, so this is important for him. But it was a challenge to carry on the conversation with him. The topic would jump around, and his meaning wasn't very clear, like he wasn't that lucid. His emotions were changing a lot. Back and forth, he would switch from complaints about social service to fear that somebody was taking his money to nostalgia about his religion. It was kind of delightful, actually, but it reminded me a little bit of the way the mind can be in meditation. You know, it's like, Have you met a mind like this, right? It's jumping around, flowing along. It has these emotions going on. When we start to tune into the substratum of what's going on in our mind, this can actually be kind of familiar. And it's a little unusual, actually, to then see it being expressed externally. But, you know, it felt familiar. But it's the same challenge then in meditation, is how do we be mindful and present for something like that? I found myself in that situation trying to do a little bit of steering, actually, which, you know, maybe we don't do in meditation, but in this case, or sometimes we do. But I felt like I wanted to bring him back to the present moment. His mind was really in all kinds of times and places, and sort of orient him more toward the good parts of his experience, you know, reminding him that of what was present for him, and so that he wouldn't get lost in these complaints and so forth. It just seemed like that was the right thing to do for a patient like this, who was kind of spinning in his own world, is to keep him grounded in reality. He was odd, possibly homeless, and sweet but somewhat paranoid, I would say. And then there came a pause in his speech, and I found myself just sitting quietly. This is something that we're trained, actually, as a chaplain, is that we don't need to talk all the time. It's good. If you've been able to do that in meditation, you can do it with other people then. So I just sat quietly. And then his face kind of cleared, and he peered at me as if he was seeing me for the first time. And he said, "Are you a Hare Krishna?" This is when I had a crew cut. Some of you know that I used to have hair that was about an eighth of an inch long. And that's what I looked like. And he said, "Are you a Hare Krishna?" And I was just flowing along with him, and I grinned and I said, "Today I am a Southern Baptist." And he cracked this huge smile, and it felt like we really connected in that moment. So that's an example of just entering into somebody's world and just being there with them, which is, you know, often what we're called to do. It's so simple, just to do it, and yet so difficult to let go of our ideas and our identities and how we think we should be and all of that. Just do what seemed to be right. Now, there are also cases where I've been challenged to meet a person who is in really deep suffering. Usually, in the hospital, there's nothing that I can directly do to relieve their pain. That's not my job. That's what the doctors are working on. But it's hard when there are even situations where it seems like I can't remove the emotional pain that's happening. And then the value is in not abandoning them, because they can't remove it either, and they're the ones that are living it, right? And so what we're doing then is modeling offering a steady presence to someone who is in a distressing situation or is in a difficult situation. And this is, again, a skill that we learn in meditation, because we encounter in our hearts those places of pain. Sometimes they just come forth in meditation, and there they are. And then the practice is not to abandon ourselves, to stay with that, to stay with what's going on. And so sometimes in these hospital situations, I hope at least that my willingness to just sit there and be with them provides maybe something that they can borrow from me in that moment, but maybe also something that they can remember as a model that they may be able to do in the future. Oh, it's possible for somebody to just sit through this. I hadn't thought of that. Often they maybe hadn't thought of that that's a possible reaction. And sometimes, not always, not always can they do that, but sometimes. And sometimes it just helps to allow my heart to break, and then theirs can break too, allowing some greater openness. So as an example, I was regularly going to the rehab unit. And there's a room at the end of the hallway in rehab, and I don't know why, but it seems like it's often occupied by someone who's going to be there for a really long time, and something about the karma of this room. And so there's this room that had been occupied for a while by the same person, but I hadn't actually gotten into it, because it seemed like there were doctors every time I went by. So I didn't necessarily go in. And one day I did go in, and I encountered kind of a haggard-looking woman at the bedside of a middle-aged man who was very thin, and his face was kind of drawn in pain, and he was either asleep or unconscious. So I spoke with her, who turned out to be his wife. And the situation was completely tragic. I mean, I won't go through the whole thing, but basically, I don't know the whole thing, of course, but what I gathered from what she said when I invited her to open is that he had come in for some kind of a fairly simple procedure in the hospital, and something had gone wrong, and so it was followed by a persistent staph infection that had then entered his spinal cord, and he was now hovering in sort of uncertain health as to whether or not, you know, how that was all going to turn out and whether there might be some permanent disability from that. Meanwhile, the rest of their lives were not, you know, there was not going in their favor either. She had been let go at work and had nearly run out their savings because he wasn't working either. And they were facing eviction because of that. And he knew nothing of this because he was unconscious most of the time. There was a mix-up with social service agencies that had delayed their food stamps. And their daughter was graduating from high school, but the father wouldn't be there. And the mother had not found the time or the wherewithal to even buy her a gift. And so she felt unhappy about that also. So basically, she, you know, sort of nothing was working in her life. And she related all of this in a sort of a tight, quiet voice while keeping her eyes fixed on the patient, on her husband. And she said that she prayed to God, but she really felt that he was testing her limits at this point. And, you know, my job was to sit there and be there. I don't know if she had ever had a chance to really tell anybody all of that. And it went on for a while to get through all of that. And I felt my own emotions, you know, going with her. And at one point, I nearly cried. And I could feel like I had to open my mouth and breathe through my mouth to be with those feelings, to allow the feelings to flow. And it's not, you know, it's not that I need to hide my emotions from people. I have actually teared up around patients. Maybe she even saw the tears, but sort of it felt right not to interrupt her with my own emotions at that point, now that she had started to finally speak. So there is a principle in this kind of spiritual care not to try to fix anything. That's not our job. But boy, that's challenging in a situation like this. I didn't quite uphold it. I did make a suggestion for how she might be able to do something for her teenage daughter. But as I, you know, as I said it, I realized, oh, I was helping, that which is maybe not helpful all the time. And so I, because of mindfulness, I was able to pull back. I mean, the reason that that happens is that we're not able to hold our own aversion, right? So we feel, instead of feeling compassion, there's a little bit of fear or a little bit of pushing away there in my own mind. And so I start to feel uncomfortable, and then I'm acting to relieve my own discomfort. And that's not necessarily helpful to her. It's not easy to stay open for something like that, but that's the challenge. And so right there, there's a lot of Buddhist practice in, can I open to this? Can I hold even this and not jump in there and try to do something? So basically what I ended up doing is I ended up turning my attention toward my own feeling of helplessness. And that was fruitful. There was this feeling like a kind of a water slide where just what had been a little bit tight and a little bit this aversive feeling of, this is horrible to listen to, just opened into this amazing compassion. Her pain was my pain, was all of humanity's pain in the face of illness and impermanence and unpredictability. And, you know, as her story wound down, all I could offer was the acknowledgement that this situation was really difficult. I was just like, wow, that is really challenging, what you're describing. And she turned and she looked me in the eye and she said, I think she said very straightforwardly, thank you for listening to me. I don't know if anybody else had ever listened to her. And there was, you know, she knew there wasn't really anything I could do, much as we would like to just wave the magic wand. But she just, you know, the listening actually mattered to her, and sometimes that's the best we can bring. So after situations like that, it's good to do some self-care. I did, I did a little bit of that. It's something of a burden to take on other people's lives like that, and so we need to care for ourselves also, which is good to remember as we're doing our practice. There are also cases where it is necessary to set some boundaries, and this is an important part of practice too, is to negotiate what can I open to and where is there a limit, or where where's the compassion, the compassion drawing a boundary. So I spoke with I remember a time also when I spoke with a man who was a Jehovah's Witness, and he was in the rehab unit, I believe. And at first, when I came in and said, how are you doing and what are you using to support yourself while you're here? And he talked about his strong faith. And so I responded favorably. If people have a way that they're okay with being in the hospital, I'm in support of that. And so I said, very good. This sounds like it's positive for you. But it did open him up to 25 minutes of proselytization that I was unable to extricate myself from. I tried really hard. It was hard to get a word in edgewise, and eventually I used physical movements. Like, I got up and I put my chair back against the wall, and so I was standing there listening to him. I sort of took a couple steps back towards the door, still listening to him. He wasn't picking up any cues. I was glad, actually, that he was feeling so well. I mean, if people are truly not feeling well, they can't do that. So I'm sure he was actually in reasonable spirits at that point. But I sat there, I was being very mindful of, wow, I'm feeling aversive to this. I'm feeling, and various ideals, played in my mind. I'm supposed to be here for people. I'm supposed to listen to people. Like, all the roles that I'm supposed to be playing, I'm playing, but they're not ending. and there was my own aversion going on there that I had to be mindful of. It's like, wow, I'm feeling impatient this is not something I'm interested in listening to, and so forth. So there's a lot of mindfulness going on through that. And finally what happened was I did interrupt him, and I said, I'm here to provide spiritual care to many people in the hospital, and I can't do that if I'm listening to you for such a long time right now, so I'm going to move on. That was what I said to him. It was very uncomfortable, actually, and it left me feeling that it had that wasn't pleasant for me to do that. I don't like to speak that way. And at the same time, I had to be true to myself in that I felt like his ongoing proselytization was taking something from me that I hadn't given. There was something being pulled away from me or asked of me that I had not given permission for, in a sense. And so at some point there rose up in me a boundary that said, no more of this. And I didn't say it that way. I didn't tell him I didn't agree or what. I didn't go there. I just said, I need to be seeing other people now. So I don't know. But I think it's worth considering that spiritual caregiving, or caregiving of any kind, is some kind of a two-way conversation. And it's not, the Buddha did not advocate that compassion for others means total self-sacrifice. Actually, the Buddha said that wisdom and compassion amount to what is good for self, good for other, and good for both. So there's a sense of, and he also says in another case, we should not sacrifice our own well-being for that of another, or for any worldly goal either, but for another being. And so there's a sense of needing to be nourished as we nourish others. and finding a way to do that. And the person who is ill, that's not their responsibility necessarily. They're not in that position. Or, you know, we need to be mindful and be aware of our situation. So this was a valuable lesson for me. You know, these encounters in the hospital don't end up perfect. But it was a valuable lesson for me in seeing, okay, how does this two-way street operate? How does compassion operate such that I'm included in the picture too? And it probably would have been self-serving for me to cut off the conversation after 5-10 minutes and just say, this is not for me, so I'm going to go. But, you know, 25-30 minutes, it started to change. I don't know. It might have been different on a different day for me. It might be different for a different person. That was how it played out. And it was very interesting to watch in my mind all those factors. The real world is not always simple. So setting a boundary, I think, can be compassionate. I think that's part of it. There's wisdom and compassion there. Now, I do encounter Buddhists sometimes. And I had a very interesting conversation with a 20-year-old Vietnamese man, a young man who had cancer, and he was Buddhist. His Buddhism was from Southeast Asia. His mother was first generation, and had this very traditional way of practicing. She worked as a spiritual fortune teller of some kind. And he was telling me about her. And she had told him that his cancer was due to his bad karma, is that he had killed somebody in a previous life, and now he was reaping the fruit of that. And that was what was going on for him. And so he wanted to know, he asked me, how he could atone for this in this lifetime. So this is an interesting question, right? And this isn't exactly my understanding of karma or my direct knowledge. I don't know about rebirth and those kinds of things, but this was part of his view, and I did share with him that I was Buddhist because that was what opened him to talking about a little bit more about his feelings of spirituality. And so that was interesting. It was interesting to probe around and kind of see if I could address those. There was also a Western Buddhist I met who was a woman who was actually she was a Nichiren practitioner, which is very different than what we do here. They mostly do chanting as their practice. It was interesting for me. This was the first Western Buddhist that I had encountered, actually. So she was, she stood out in my mind. And the particular situation there was that it happened that the way the encounters for me had flowed that day is that I had seen just before her a Catholic person who wanted prayer. And so I had just offered a Catholic prayer, which I'm not super skilled at. I always feel a little like I don't speak the language. I had done that, and then I came in to see her, and she had a spinal cord injury of some kind, and I think was partially paralyzed. She didn't have a lot going on below her chest level, basically, and so she wanted a guided meditation. And so I did a guided metta with her as also kind of a body, not quite a body scan because she didn't have awareness, but sending love through her body even though she couldn't feel all of it. And for me, the powerful practice was the night and day of the Catholic prayer and the Buddhist guided meditation. I mean, there's a range, of course, in how comfortable and at ease we are in offering care in a certain situation. And I think it was kind of the two ends of the spectrum right next to each other in those two encounters, which was useful for me to see, right? Because it's an ongoing inquiry for me in doing this work of how to be authentic. And this is totally relevant in our daily life also. How do we show up true to what's happening inside of us, true somehow to the situation around us, not sacrificing one for the other too much, hopefully harmonizing them in some way. There's a lot of the path is about harmonizing inner and outer. And this occurs in the moment as we think about what to say right now in response to what that person just said. And it happens over the course of our lifetime as we learn more and more about who we are and as we get more and more skilled about living in a way that is aligned with our heart. That's what the path is about, in case you weren't sure. Not only what it's about, there's an aim, of course, but a lot of the practice is in this kind of alignment, learning how to do that. It's so mundane. A lot of the path is so... The result is not, but a lot of the nitty-gritty practice is very real world. So, sorry I got off a little bit on that, but essentially it helps to see where is it that I feel really comfortable being and where is it that I don't, and can I be at ease? I don't think it's about eliminating all the places where we don't feel authentic. I think it's about learning to be at ease with a range of everything that we're going to encounter. That ease is the aim, is to get to that. Okay, so the particular day I saw this Nichiren practitioner, she was in a good spirits, actually. She had just gotten there recently and was very optimistic that everything was going to go well. And then I saw her again about 3 weeks later, and her perseverance was wearing a little thinner because it was clearer by that point that not as much of her function was going to come back as she wanted. And I was so happy that, I read a little bit about this chanting that the Nichiren faith offers. And so when I came in and she seemed to be a little flagging a little bit, I asked her if she'd been doing her chanting, because that's her practice. And she said no, that it just hadn't really worked out in the hospital to do that. And so I said, why don't we do it? And we chanted Nyamyo Renge Kyo, which is the ongoing chant that they do. And I said, you know, that this isn't my particular strand of Buddhism, but I would so much like if you would teach me how to do that. I know the words, but I don't know the spirit of it. And she brightened up and she, you know, I had shown interest. And so she started and I joined in. And we chanted together for some time. And she looked so happy. You know, it's so simple to offer somebody what it is that they need in that moment. Not easy always, but can be simple. So that was fulfilling in a certain way, is to have encountered another Western Buddhist. So another thing that I do at the hospital is I've been asked to lead meditation in the psychiatric ward once a month. And this is like working with six-year-olds, because they have a very short attention span and they also don't have a lot of restraint on their emotions about disrupting the group. So when given the chance, someone may open up and tell a really long story, which is kind of good. But then you might have to kind of then the other people can't pay attention very long, right? So there's kind of gathering the group together. Other people have issues where they speak out of turn or they're not able to be silent, and so then it's a little challenging to do the meditation because they're talking. But, you know, this is also like directing the mind. The mind can be like a six-year-old. And it's a compassion practice to figure out how to orient the whole group. And I don't have any illusion that I'm teaching them to meditate and that they're going to go and do this in their room regularly or something like that. Although, if they did, that would be good. Some of them do have a regular spiritual practice. But I think what's better in the long run is for the compassion to be just totally, and the generosity just be totally free and just say that for this half an hour, their mind was in a better place than it would have been if they weren't sitting in meditation class, and that's what there was to offer. And that works well, and I find myself, it's fresh for me to go and do it every time. I have no ongoing expectations. It's often a different group of people anyway. It's interesting. I was a little unsure about that at first, but now I find that I enjoy it. I found that they like bells, so I bring my bells, and I ring the bells. I tried singing with them. That didn't go so well, so it's experimental, but it's a great opportunity to work with very, very different minds, I would say. So perhaps there are areas in your life also where sometimes we need to be flexible and light and just be with the reality of what's happening. Sometimes we need our heart to break without turning away. Sometimes we need to set boundaries, or sometimes we need to just open to a situation that's totally beyond what we can imagine. But there you are. You're supposed to offer yourself in some way. So I think the mark of learning is that we can do something now that we couldn't do before, right? And so, of course, there are numerous learnings from something as intense as volunteering as a spiritual caregiver, but basically, maybe it could be summarized as I now feel almost no anxiety about walking into a situation where I have no idea what's going on or who all those people are and how they're related, and just offering. Can I offer spiritual care in some way? I even have confidence that I can do that there can be some provision of care, at least most of the time. And it's not perfect and it's not textbook and all of that, but it's something. And I don't think I had that confidence at the beginning. I really felt self-conscious about standing before that door and thinking, am I about to open this door, and what's going to be there, and how am I going to meet it? And now I think that's okay. You know, I'm okay with that. And this also is what we're asked to do on the cushion. You sit down on that cushion and you close your eyes. It's like opening a door. And you don't know who's there and what's it going to be like. Now you get familiar with your own mind, right? So maybe the acid test is then to go do it with somebody else's mind. But this is a significant change, you know, to have that willingness, have that openness. And I think practice prepares us to be able to do that sometime in some way. Not necessarily the way I've described tonight, but sometime in some way we're going to be called to do that. And the fruit of the practice is that we really can. That's something that the mind is being shaped into being able to do. That's one of the potentials that gets developed. Some of the factors that shape this are the ability to allow strong emotions to move through the system. And I say the system, I mean the mind-body system that we are. Can we allow a strong emotion to arise in that and have its life and pass? Because that's going to happen. And the degree to which we have the attentional strength to hold that is the degree to which we can stay present and actually be helpful in an emotional situation, right? Also, this kind of work will completely undermine any self-concern you have about doing it right. I have no idea if I do it right in a given situation. What does that even mean? Right is I was as present as I could be. I was as compassionate as I could be in that moment. I'm meeting people I haven't met before. I don't know much about their background. I don't even get their medical information on my little chaplain sheet, so I don't know what they're there for unless they tell me. I'm only going to encounter them for as long as the situation lasts, which could be just a few minutes or could be a little longer. It could end naturally, or it could end because the doctor comes in and that's it, you're gone, you know. Who knows? So all these concerns about, am I going to get it right? Did I say the right thing? Those take up brain space that is better used with being present and just doing the best I can. So this is, I mean, this is a letting go of the self, this selfing behavior. Am I okay? Am I doing it right? What should I do now? Not that those thoughts don't appear, but they have less weight for me now than I think they did when I was more uptight about doing that. And this bleeds over into other areas in life. It's very useful to let go a bit like that. And also this, you know, this work can't help but expand the heart qualities. You know, we're going to develop love and compassion and equanimity and sympathetic joy. One time I came into a room and it was like a celebration. There was 12 people in the room, and one of them was videoing what was going on, and there was like balloons and joy, and I don't know, maybe the person was leaving. I actually, as soon as I opened the door, I was like, oh, I don't know that they need spiritual care right now. They look like they're doing pretty well. And actually what happened was they were all caught up in their excitement of whatever was so joyful in this room, and one of them turned to me and said, hey, do you have a pen I could borrow? So I gave them my pen. And then he said, great, thanks. And he took it and turned right back, and I was out of his picture. So I turned and walked out without a pen. I figured, well, I'll get another pen, maybe from the nurse's desk. That was what I had to offer. That was, sometimes you don't know what you're supposed to offer when you get into the room. It turned out that the pen was it for that room. Now, the funny thing is I just went on. I let go. I said, great, they're happy. I went on to the next room. And then, you know, like 15, 20 minutes later, I had come all the way around, and some of the people from that celebration were leaving. They were going out to the elevator, and one of them was the guy who had asked for my pen, and he saw me, and he said, oh, thanks for the pen, and he gave it back after I had gone and gotten one from the nurse's station. So there you go. You just never know. So those are my thoughts for this evening on, you know, approaching life with a sense of engaging with compassion and with liberation. You know, how can I be free and how can I be compassionate in this moment? And it's some crazy moment that's appearing and you don't know necessarily what the best thing is, but we open and we do the best we can. And I like to think that, in fact, I'm kind of mind-boggled that sitting quietly on a cushion with my eyes closed is really good preparation for that. Who would have thought? So there's some time. It would be great if anybody had any comments or stories to share or questions about compassion or this kind of work, or sharing something that you think has been a fruit of your practice in terms of compassion and liberation. Yeah, if you could use the mic, that'd be great.
Well, I don't usually come on Thursday, but something got me here, and it was the right message because I have a friend who's at Valley Medical in rehab, and who'd have thought? And she had a terrible bike accident and fell on her head at going like 30 miles an hour. And so she's having a lot of cognitive dissonance, I guess you could say. And it's kind of hard for me to imagine her in that state because she's somebody who's very... she's always like the one who, when she comes into a room, everybody's like, ooh, you know, she just has that kind of energy. She like lifts the room and she's kind of feisty and, you know, all these things that I really love about her. And so when I've heard some of the stories, like, you know, she calls her husband 50 times an hour, and so don't bring in your cell phone. I mean, there's like a lot of rules to go visit her, and I've been afraid to go see her. because it's unfamiliar, and you know, what will I do if she says, "Give me your phone" or something? You know, that's kind of her, you know, that's become her kind of her behavior. And so, in listening to you, I see the possibility of you know, not having to resist it, and even suggesting maybe we meditate for a minute. You know, maybe that's all she can do, but. You know, that never occurred to me. I thought I'd come in like this, you know, the boss, and here's how it's going to be, you know. And I mean, I wouldn't talk that way, but that's how it has felt. Call me before you go, because there's a bunch of rules you have to follow. And so I'm visiting her Sunday, and this is great to have this, you know, to have this sort of new, like I said, new possibility for just being with her in whatever state she's in. So. Thank
Beautiful.
You.
If you carry that intention, it's going to go fine.
So, Kim, I'm curious, how do we know how much self-care we need? I grew up Catholic, and so I haven't been filled with a lot of information about that. But it's not sustainable to not know.
So it sounds like you're asking because you're feeling like maybe there hasn't been enough self-care for you. Is that the case? Yeah. Yeah, so self-care is so important when we're wanting to support others, right? We need to be standing on stable ground in order to support someone else. And one way that I think about self-care is to feel internally whether I feel like I'm being nourished in a given situation or drained, essentially. And this is an internal feeling that only you would know in a situation. And some of it is, so just being attuned to that dimension, what it does is it helps me orient my mind toward being, say, compassionate instead of trying to fix or, you know, opening to love and appreciation as opposed to trying to control, you know, their behaviors in my internally that are nourishing and supportive, and other ways of relating that tighten me up or otherwise drain me. So at the beginning of an encounter or in a situation, then what we're doing is we're attuning ourselves to make sure that we're in a good relationship with what's going on. And then at some point, if you stay attuned to, am I still feeling nourished? Is this still working? There comes a point where we can feel that our capacity is being a little bit exceeded or our balance is being challenged in that area. And this is just natural. You know, we're not infinite wells of, in most people, in most situations, are not infinite wells of these good qualities. And even, you know, the body gets tired, the mind gets tired. So then, you know, just having this little check-in, am I being supported somehow by this situation? And if it starts to feel like that's sliding down, then it's a time for self-care, to turn more of the attention inward, like a little bit like what I did when I was talking with that woman who was telling me the amazingly tragic story. I was getting a little bit drained when I was in a feeling of horror at all the details she was telling me. And then it helped that there was that moment where I turned toward my own helplessness. And so I was noticing that at that point I was starting to be a little drained, and I turned toward my own helplessness, and that gave me a fresh surge of compassion at that moment, to feel that her pain was connected to mine and to everyone else's. And that, we have to remember that compassion is actually supportive. But nonetheless, I still felt afterwards that, you know, there was a little bit of need to to take care of that. So I think the internal attunement, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question directly, but it is, I think this draining versus nourishing might be a good dimension to start with. Does that resonate at all for you? Or are there further questions that could come?
I don't know what time it is, so I don't want to take up a lot of time.
We've got about 3 more minutes.
Oh, God.
Then but I'm willing to stay afterwards also. That's right. I'm not at all cut. I actually meant that to sound spacious. It's but if you'd rather talk afterwards, that's
fine.
I'm
just thinking someone else might have
one. Does anyone else have something on their mind? People may want to hear this, Mary.
So if we're not spiritual caregivers, but we're involved with some kind of stuff out there in the community, or with our family, or that knowledge of how to draw the line is so tricky.
Yeah, it is. I don't know that in those situations you're not a spiritual caregiver. Yeah, we're bringing our heart, and anytime we're bringing our heart in some way to what we're doing, the spiritual dimension is important. There may be other dimensions that are important too, but to some degree you can experiment with it also. If you're, you know, it's not, I hope what I tried to convey today is that it's not always clear, it's not always going to be perfect, and so it is going to be perfect in some sense, but, you know, according to our ideals, it may not look perfect. And so it's possible that you could just try something. Like if you've been feeling like you've been giving in too much and giving and not doing enough self-care, deliberately say to somebody, you know what, I'm going to take a 10-minute break right now because I'm feeling a little challenged. And just see what that does, you know. And if it turns out that doesn't generate a good reaction or it doesn't feel right to you to do that, you may not know whether it feels right until you actually do it, unfortunately. We can't just imagine these things. And you have to actually do the act. And if it turned out it wasn't quite the right thing, then you try something else the next time until you get a sense of how is it that I can create a boundary in this situation, or how is it that I can take care of myself. And it's okay to experiment a little bit. We're going to get, especially if it's an ongoing situation, we're going to get lots of chances. So I hope maybe to encourage a little bit of experimentation, if you're confident in that, yeah. And it's okay. It's all in the spirit of learning. You do it mindfully and with a heart intending to help and to do the right thing and do something beneficial, I should say. And if it turns out wasn't quite right, then we fine-tune. All right, thanks everyone.